It started as a paddock and it became a wonderland of terraced botanical displays, intricate parterre, maze-like pathways and spectacular colour. It's a piece of magnificence captured in a new book. Tim Entwistle journeyed to West Gippsland in eastern Victoria to take in the magnificence of Broughton Hall.
I'm out at Broughton Hall at Jindavik and I'm with David Musker, who's the landscape designer of a spectacularly beautiful garden. It's just coming into blossom, the perfect time to see it. But David, first up, what's your background and tell us a bit about Jindavik.
Sure. Well, Jindavik, first off, is a small country town in West Gippsland. The centre of the town was all about forestry. So initially it was all about logging because this was a bush area. So there were lots of loggers here cutting down trees. And then when they all left, it became a dairy farm area. So it's the best dairy country in Victoria, probably close to the best in Australia, really. 1.2 metres of rain a year.
So it's a wet place. But I saw, I think it was your partner, Philip, Hunter wrote in a book about this garden. He described it as a little bit like all creatures great and small. It's got that kind of bucolic feel, hasn't it?
Yeah, look, a very small community, 300 people. Many of them have been here for a long, long time. And you're never a local, that sort of story. But and they're honest people that have done it tough, that are, you know, have lived a good life in the country and probably live a lot longer than all of us because of that. And they've been very kind to us and we've got on very well with all of them. So we've had a great time here, really.
Now, David, you've been at this place, I think it's probably more than 25 years now. And when you began here, there was no garden.
28 years ago, we stood here and on this very spot, actually. And
So actually, describe what we're looking at before.
Yeah. Okay, so it was a rolling hill. It was quite a steep roll and there was a fence about halfway down, probably where the cherries are. And there was another paddock below that and they were just literally bare paddocks. Once, of course, huge trees all over it, but they were all cut down then burnt up, and it was just paddocks. So it did have an amazing view, but that's all it was. And we sat here and imagined what we could build as a house. And once we designed the house and we had the house sited, then I could start the garden, because it was all about that central axis.
Yeah, and where we're standing, we're looking down through some pretty tidy parterre. So this is a very it's a very formal garden. And as you say, there's blossom trees heading off down the hill. We can see a lake and mountains. Where's Baw-Baw? Mount Baw-Baw?
So Mount Baw-Baw's over there.
Over to our right. So, yeah. Oh, wow. So look, this is, as you say, a spectacular sight and an amazing garden. The design of this garden, though, this is the main axis?
Yeah, look, the house is Georgian. It has a central axis, so the axis runs through the front gate, which is halfway into the birch forest, up to the front door, and then out to the domed library in the middle of the house, through the lounge room, and out through the garden. So that gave me, you know, on paper, a pencil line that went right through it. And that was a starting point in terms of the drawing, and I did the drawing for the garden as the house was being built, and we started the first section, this top terrace area, when we moved into the house, and continued the rest of it from the original drawing. So, interestingly enough, the rock outcrop at the very, very bottom was drawn, 28 years ago and completed about 5 years ago.
Let's actually walk down towards there. And the size, just to give you guys a sense of the scale of this garden, how big's the whole created garden?
Yeah, we've never measured it and everyone asks. It's silly, isn't it? But I think it's around 5 acres, 5 or 6.
Okay.
It seems to get bigger and smaller depending on the time of year.
But that's, 5 acres is a lot of area to garden, though.
It is, and particularly if you want to, I mean, people say it's tidy, but, you know, it sounds like I'm obsessive. But I think if you're opening a garden, we open 7 months a year. So if you open a garden for 7 months a year, you've got to keep it looking reasonably good. So like the botanic gardens, well, not like that at all, but in that style, you've got to keep the edges sharp, the paths weeded. You can't really have it open looking bad because people don't come back.
No, and the other thing with public gardens is you have to treat it differently. Like, you're going to have lots of people walking through, so the paths have to be withstand all that footprints. Yeah. But also, you know, public amenities, and it's quite a different garden. Was it always going to be a public garden when you designed it?
No, it wasn't. But I think it's interesting. We opened it very, very early on. So once it was all framed and planted with the basic initial planting and the gravel paths were mostly in, we opened it with the Open Gardens of Victoria. I'd had a garden previous to this open and they watched this one developing, and 5 years into it we opened the garden. I wasn't that keen on the idea, but they were very keen on it. So we opened it, and it's interesting that people really appreciate coming back to see the garden, having said they saw it when it was only 5 years old and it was tiny, you know, and the box hedging was weeny and everything was little baby things. So it's kind of cool that people got to see that development. But it got to the stage where we opened twice a year and we had maybe 2,500 people for a weekend, and it was, you know, it was kind of fun, but it was also horrible. The only alternative was to either close it or to open it over an extended period. So we open 7 months a year at the moment, and that's probably very fair. It's more or less a public garden. We keep it closed for 5 months.
Well, that's interesting though, because so the fact that you do see a garden like this is behind all that has to be public in a way. I mean, you could have not opened it at all and just sat here and enjoyed your gin and tonics in the evening and that kind of thing.
We still do that. We could have kept it closed. But I suppose we could have kept it closed and just kept it to ourselves. But I think when you create something like this, part of the joy of it is the visitation and the effect it has on people. And, you know, gardens are all different and they all carry different things with them. But the best gardens, regardless of planting and style, give people joy and peace. And I think if you can do that, you know, it's worth opening.
So you're interested in, I mean, there's landscapes here, but also individual plants. That's something, you know, gardeners fall into sometimes two camps, ones that are all about plants and ones that, you know, like the look of the green.
Yeah.
You're a plants person?
I think I'm a designer, but I'm also a plants person. In the beginning, I was actually a design teacher and lecturer. And I think, you know, this whole thing is about like a painting, like a drawing, like a piece of design. Putting a garden together is that just that, really. And so the combination of that blue-grey spiky foliage with this fabulous oak leaf pelargonium sitting around it,
yeah,
and then the colour of that behind it. So it's all that tiering.
There's pinks, there's yellows, so it's quite a lot of colour. And that's you're not going for the kind of the one colour feel or the dull palette.
No, look, I've always been known for pretty strong colour. So it's the combination of textures and shapes and colours that make a garden interesting, I think. And the rarer things offer a lot more interest in that style, you know, the Sonchus, the Russ sitting there, and of course the Cassonia in the background looking amazing. So, yeah, combinations of things, I think.
And you've got, I mean, talking about sort of groups of plants, I know there's certain things like roses particularly. I remember from my last visit, a particular passion, something I know very little about. How would you describe your rose collection, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, well, it is a rose collection. My partner, Philip, my husband, Philip, loves roses, and so that's why we started with the roses. But I insisted if we were going to do it, we were going to do it historically. Yeah. So we ended up planting some very, very old roses up at the top and drifting it right through to more contemporary roses. So it's actually got a historic context. I think that's important.
Yeah. We're in the colonnade, would you call this?
We call it the column walk. It's just a whole lot of concrete columns unpainted, yeah, as a walk.
So yeah, would you call this formal or not formal? Because in a way, obviously formal because there's these very regular columns. But on the other hand, it's like one of those, I don't know, the Greek or Italian or Mediterranean garden that's sort of in decay almost.
Yeah, yeah, it's got that feel of a ruin, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's not finished. I'm not sure about the formality of it, really. I think it's a lot looser than at the top of the house. And as we go further towards the rock outcrop, it gets sort of softer and more dramatic in a way.
Now, we better get to your favourite tree or we'll miss out. Let's head back up to the top of the garden. So we'll go up the steps and make our way through a few more plants and a few more garden beds. So we're coming through, well, it's a perennial garden, I guess. So you've got grasses and a lot of colour, and this is a new part of the garden.
Yeah, look, this was done when we were in lockdown and COVID and we thought it was going to be the end of the world. And it took a while, but it's been, so it'd be 3 years now, I think? Yeah. So the first 2 years it was, you know, it struggled because we weren't, it was new. So the soil was settling and the mulch was, you know, everything was just establishing slowly. It looks fantastic now. It's been in 3 or 4 years, and we've learned a lot too. You know, you think with a perennial garden that you don't need to water it, but in fact we've realised that you do have to water this quite a lot to keep the things that are delicate looking fabulous. So if you want to stretch out your season, you need to water a perennial garden. That's my tip.
And also the care of it, you've also got to keep working on it. They look like they've been thrown together, but it's not quite like that.
No, you've got to pull things out. I mean, some things, this beautiful Halorhagis erecta, Wellington bronze, I'm not sure if it's a common name, sorry, but that's got this beautiful brown foliage. So it's a fantastic looking thing. But you can see from this, just where we are right now, we've got like 30 of them. So we'll go through this and take 20 of them out. So it's managing all of that. While you're letting nature have a go, you're also controlling it to a point and trying to manage it to keep that balance.
Yeah, so they can be hard to look after. Let's get out of this wind too, if we can. So, David, we've finally got to your favourite tree. So I took a bit of a wander around, but we're up on top of the hill. We're near an old, relatively old house. And you've taken me to an oak tree. Now, this hasn't been set up, but this is a particularly special kind of oak, as I can tell by the bark.
Yeah. So the Spanish cork oak. But, the interesting thing is about this tree is the story. And this property was cleared in 1910 and settled by white Australians in 1910. Before that, it was bush. So in 1910, a family that we no longer know chose somehow to plant a cork oak. They planted an English oak, a cork oak, and two or three deodars. They also planted some poplars. That's about it. That's remained. But I find it remarkable and romantic and intriguing that they would, in this harsh climate, building a house and cutting down trees and pretty tough world, plant a cork oak.
So they planted trees that are not from here, which is interesting, yeah. I suppose, in the first place. It's introducing something they were familiar with. So the oak or the English oak over there and the cedars, I guess, make sense. The cork oak does seem like a slightly more eccentric choice.
I think it's a very romantic choice, and I love the fact that they planted it. Interestingly, of course, they didn't plant it far enough away from the other trees. But what's that, 5 metres, 6 metres?
Yeah.
I guess when they were tiny, that looked close enough, but far enough apart. But now, of course, we've up-pruned the English oak to give the cork oak more space, very gently without changing the balance of the English oak. And the cork oak's now shooting back into that gap. So it should be right.
Is this a tree that you've, or a species, I suppose, the cork oak that you know from anywhere else as well? Or is this the one that you're most familiar with?
Oh, well, I've seen them around, of course, and I sell them in the nursery. This one obviously proves that they grow so well in Gippsland that we've sold a lot because of this tree. And it's great to think there's a lot more of them out there now.
So with this oak and also all the plantings in the garden, you must be thinking about climate change. You mentioned you've got lots of water here, so I suppose it's not as dire as some places. But there'll be warmer summers, changes in rainfall patterns, and perhaps some change in palette. So have you started to think about that with the whole garden as well?
Yeah, look, it's been interesting, I think. Up until about 4 years ago, we didn't have water in the garden at all. So we put water right through it 4 years ago because we had a really bad drought and we could see things suffering. And we used the water a bit that year, but we've used it an awful lot each year since. So I would say from early December right through till autumn, we water. And that's a big change. And, it's not that much. It sounds like the first time you water at night and you put the sprinklers on, the smell of the water hitting the warm soil and the warm leaves, the beautiful smell is fantastic, right? But dragging hoses around, giant hoses, and connecting up sprinklers and turning them on and checking the water and pumping the water, it's not that much fun by the end of summer. So it's certainly a thing, and it's a big thing. It takes a lot of time. We're very lucky that we've got a spring on the other side of the property that hasn't run out yet, and we've got a pumping rights on the reservoir as well, so we've got total water security, so we're very, very lucky. But there's also that moral thing, isn't there? Like, how much do you get a plant that's inappropriate? Well, we don't. So in the last 2 years, I've only planted in autumn. We don't plant in spring anymore at all. And things that survive through winter and then early spring on their own will last through to summer. And we don't plant as much as we used to. We're careful in what we plant now, and we mark everything very carefully on a map so we know what we're maintaining.
David Musker and also Philip Hunter, who's not with us here on the tour today, but you've also got Josh, your assistant gardener. We should mention Josh.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, well, Josh is fantastic. So we're very lucky. We've got a young guy called Josh working here, and he's doing a Certificate 3 or Certificate 4 in horticulture. Yeah, it's cool. So he's learning about plants, he's learning about combinations, he's learning about garden maintenance, and he's certainly developing a lot of skills, and it's great to walk around the garden in the morning with him and talk to him about the projects for the day, the projects for the week and the month and the year, and what needs to be done immediately, what needs to be done later on. You know, he's really in tune with the whole thing, and it's great to see young gardeners. It's fantastic. It's exciting.
So you're planning for the future there as well as with climate change.
Well, we hope we can train as many young people into gardening as we possibly can. And the more we can do to educate, the better.
Thanks, David. All right, let's. Can we go back into the garden again now?
Thanks.
Oh, back into the garden, Tim. Blueprint friend Tim Entwistle amidst the lovely exotica of Broughton Hall near Jindavik. Tim's guide was David Musker, landscape designer at Broughton Hall.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.